You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hello, everyone. Nice to be with you again for our weekly look at the American League Central. I'm Anthony Kastrovitz. Thanks for tuning in. The White Sox seem to pick the right time for their first adversity of the season because a 2-4 road trip did not cost them any ground in the Central. We'll talk to Scott Merkin about that. And we'll also check in with Jordan Bastian on the Indians, Jeffrey Flanagan on the Royals, Jason Beck on the Tigers, and Rhett Bollinger will join us to talk about the Twins. Let's get to it. The Royals took 2 of 3 from the Braves over the weekend. It was their first series win since way back April 22nd and 24th. That's a long time coming for a Royals team accustomed to winning series, including the World Series, I might add. They did it with a Kendrys Morales home run and extra innings. How much did he need that one? How much did they need that one?
Yeah, I guess he kind of has Wade Davis to thank for that, because that never would have happened if Wade hadn't blown his first save since last July. But, yeah, especially from the left side of the plate where he's really struggled. He just can't seem to lay off the soft stuff down and in. And, you know, a lot of fans have been asking me, you know, why doesn't he just hit right-handed all the time, and not realizing that his splits would probably go down pretty far if he was trying to go righty versus righty. But anyway, that was a big home run for him personally. Obviously a huge one for the team, because they, you know, losing 2 out of 3 at home to the Braves would not have been a good look for this team, especially the way they've been struggling lately. So they somehow managed to grind it out. You know, Kendrys had a great at-bat, hit a 3-2 pitch over the center field wall, and a lot of celebrating afterwards.
Yeah, I bet, because they've lost 13 of 19 overall, so, you know, take the victories when you can get them right now. But, you know, so much of the Royals getting back on track will come down to the rotation, giving them some consistency. And obviously last week was an interesting week for the rotation with Chris Medlin and Chris Young both go on the DL. Medlin with a rotator cuff inflammation and Young with a right forearm strain. Jeffrey, what is the severity of these two situations?
It doesn't seem very serious with Chris Young. I talked to him yesterday briefly, and he's going to start throwing actually again this week, maybe as soon as today or tomorrow. So, they, you know, he had a shot. Inflammation is getting calmed down a little bit. So I would think he'd probably be the first one back after he does 15 days on the DL. Chris Medlin, you know, there's no timetable set. They talked about him possibly resume throwing later in the week. He's on a no-throw program right now, but that inflammation, too, needs to calm down a little bit. Just kind of popped up during his last start, which was in Cleveland and wasn't a very pretty one either. But fortunately for the Royals, they do have some depth there. Dylan G, they signed in the offseason, you know, came in and against the Braves and threw 5 shutout innings. He kind of lost his release point in the 6th inning. He gave up a few runs and a loss, but overall, that's probably what they were expecting from him, a pretty good outing. Danny Duffy could go for 4 of the spots there for Medlin's spot on Sunday, and was very strong for 3 innings. I think he had 5 Ks and just 1 hit allowed, 3 shutout innings. So he'll get stretched out a little bit more, and if they can get Danny on track, and he's been pitching really well all year in the rotation, that's going to really help.
Yeah, obviously he was on a pretty strict pitch limit given the 3 mm-hmm. innings there. But I saw they have an off day come up in the schedule. Is that one where they'll leave Duffy in the bullpen for a few days before stretching him out? Or what's the plan there, as you know it?
As of this point, I'm not sure. Yeah. You know, it could be either one of those guys who might get skipped, or they might just want to give their top 3 guys an extra day. So that's the kind of thing we'll have to talk to Ned about this week.
Well, one thing, they got to be encouraged with Duffy. He's really cut down on his walks this season. That's been a nice change of pace for him. And on the flip side, a guy who doesn't draw many walks, as we know, is Alcides Escobar, the leadoff spot. And, you know, his season line, Jeffrey, is not exactly a beautiful thing to behold. But he has had a nice May. He's at 344 in May. Of course, he's only walked twice in those 14 games, which is pretty typical of him. But had a really nice day Sunday, and it's kind of like it was just sort of getting to the point where you really got to make it a point of conversation. Should he be taken out of the leadoff spot? But seems to be redeeming himself here lately. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, if you want to get your head chewed off, just ask Ned about that. because he'll quickly point to, you know, their overall record since he moved, you know, Eske in the top spot. But certainly it's a conversation point among the fans, especially when you're losing like they have been, and he hasn't been producing. But, you know, he's had some streaks here in May where, you know, he's had a couple of four-hit games already this month. So when he's right, you know, the offense gets going because, you know, you can get on base and take an extra base and pretty good base runner overall, and just really had a terrific game yesterday. Doubled the lead off the game and scored. Had a great at bat in the eighth inning where he fouled off. I think it was a 13-pitch at bat, and then kind of flared one into right field for an RBI hit that turned out to be a pretty big run at the time. So, you know, he has his moments, and I think unless the bottom drops out, I don't see him getting pushed out of the top spot.
Yeah, here's a note for you. Entering the week, Escobar's .298 career on-base percentage was the lowest among any player currently on a major league roster with 3,000 career plate appearances.
Wow.
So, certainly not what you expect from a leadoff guy, but the Royals, you know, they clearly made it work for them, and Escobar was so huge for them last October, too. So I know Ned doesn't like to tinker with his lineups much, and he likes to stick with what's worked for him in the past, so that's worked with him in the past and hopefully in the future.
I'll add one thing, too, Anthony. I mean, this team, as you know, you've seen them plenty of times, too, is that they do a lot of things unconventionally, so, and that's just one of many. So,
Absolutely. Sometimes unconventional works. Now that he's been around for more than a week, what have you thought of Chesler Cuthbert at third base?
Well, he was so good his first seven games or so that, you know, fans were starting to cry for, hey, where can we move him when Moose comes off the DL? You know, can he play second? Can he play right? You know, can he play shortstop? I mean, just kind of just crazy stuff going on. And the truth is he's only played, I think, five professional games at second base in his life, two innings in the major leagues during a mop-up game last year. And I'm not saying he can't do it, but, you know, there's a lot to learn. You just can't just plug these guys in anywhere. There's a lot of footwork that he'd have to learn. But since then, of course, since the big outcry about where is he going to end up, I think he's not had a hit. So typical of the way things go in baseball. Didn't look particularly good yesterday at the plate or the day before. So, but I tell you one thing, he is a really outstanding defensive third baseman. And as you know, that's what matters most here in Kansas City. You got to be able to defend first. And he's really made some highlight reel plays. It's just he's got almost as good an arm as Moose does. And he's got really good range. And he's very fearless in the field. And they haven't really missed a beat defensively.
And everything's still on track, I assume, to hopefully have Moose back after the 15-day window.
Yeah, I think it might actually be stretch that out maybe another week. I talked to him yesterday, the day before, and there's still some swelling in there. He still feels it a little bit. He was taking some dry swings the last couple of days, and he's going to hit some flips here pretty soon and just see what it feels like to have contact with that hand. And he's already been playing catch, and he said that's gotten better. But this early in the season, we're not even at Memorial Day, you take your time and make sure that thing gets healed. So I would think it's probably going to be closer to 3 weeks.
Joined now by Scott Merkin. And Merk, White Sox are coming off a 2-4 road trip. I don't know if that qualifies as adversity, but if so, it's probably their first real bout with adversity so far in this regular season. What were your takeaways from that trip?
Well, I believe they're 1-3-1 in their last five series. And their only win is against Minnesota, who obviously is not having a good season at all. I think, you know, what you expected was going to happen. This team was not going to run away and win 110 games. And I guess they still could. They're still 10 games over. But there were going to be points where they struggled. And excuse me, that was this road trip. You know, I mean, the bullpen was not good on this road trip. You know, a turning point probably in the trip was, I believe it was game two, when they gave up seven runs in the eighth inning to the Rangers and lost 13-11. Excuse me. So that will change things right away. But I just think, you know, the bullpen's been great all year. The starting pitching's been decent all year. The defense has been good all year. And the defense remained good. It just had a costly error in the series finale against the Yankees. Mm-hmm. But, you know, things are going to be up and down. It's just the way it goes. And they're entering a real crucial part, even in late May. You know, eventually we're going to be saying it's September, but right now it's still late May, 38 games in. So we'll see how they kind of right the ship with it. You know, they were all pretty excited about not just having a day off after the Yankee series, but having a day off at home, too. So we'll see how they regroup with Houston coming to town on Tuesday.
Appropriately enough, you guys were in New York on Sunday, and Sunday marked the start of Joe DiMaggio's hit streak. I say appropriately enough because you had a cool story about Robin Ventura and his hitting streak for Oklahoma State in 1987, 58 games, Division I record. What do you have to say about that hit streak versus that of Joe DiMaggio?
Well, he as many people agree, don't think anyone will even come close to Joe DiMaggio's streak. What was it? I guess the closest in modern time is Pete Rose, and he was still 12 games short, right? I mean, he was still he was still a good hitting streak away from tying Joe DiMaggio's hitting streak. You know, so I mean, these guys who have hit 38, 39 in a row, which is amazing, are almost a month away still from tying Joe DiMaggio's streak, which is just kind of crazy. I mean, I think you put that up there with the Cal Ripken streak, and those, and I guess Cy Young's win total also will probably never be touched. And those are records that you can look at and just say, well, you know, it's nice to have set, and you can shoot for him somewhere else. But, yeah, I thought it was interesting and very true to Robin Ventura's character in that, you know, he appreciated what he did, he liked what he did, but he was more concerned about the team's push to the national title that year. They lost in the championship to Stanford with Jack McDowell, who he ended up becoming teammates with in the White Sox, who was part of the shutdown game and the end of his hitting streak, the second to last game of the College World Series. And that's what he cared more about. And he was more worried about, you know, having singular attention on him take away from the great things the team was doing. And that's pretty much how he manages. And I didn't cover him when he played, but that's how much, that's from what I've been told, how he played too, you know. So, I mean, he appreciated the record, but it's not something that I think he sits and dwells about or, you know, sits with his family and says, hey, remember that time I hit in 58 straight or 58 straight for Oklahoma State? That was great. I think he just, you know, it's there. And an interesting thing, and I don't know if you'd agree with this, Anthony, and I think it'd be some, a player like this. He thought that in his prime, Ichiro was the best bet to break the record just because of the fact that, you know, Ichiro would hit routine grounders to short and somehow beat them out for infield hits. And that's almost how you have to have that because, let's face it, even the guys on the best rolls are not going to hang out line drives for 56 straight games. You got to have a bloop in there. You got to have an infield hit, broken bat hit somewhere. And he thought Ichiro. So they pretty much, people who talked about it pretty much think, you know, good speed, good contact guy. Not necessarily, even guys like Mike Trout, they didn't think would be a candidate because, you know, he's a power guy who strikes out a little bit. So Ichiro, when he mentioned it, was a perfect candidate. I thought, obviously not going to do it now. He's not going to play that many games in a row, but would have been a great candidate in his prime, I thought.
Yeah, at this point, Ichiro would just be happy to play in 56 straight games. But that's another topic for another time.
Can you think of anyone off the top of your head? I can't really think of anyone, like, you know, just that jumps out at you that you could say, well, this is a guy. I mean, I guess it's hard to pick a guy who you can say even the best of guys aren't going to hit in 56 games in a row, you know?
Yeah, it's too hard to even get a hit in today's game with the shifts and everything.
Right.
Yeah, and the media pressure. But, you know, Adam Eaton had a streak of a different sort that was snapped on Sunday. I think it was, I want to say 62 plate appearances without a strikeout, maybe 61. But it was the longest active streak in baseball at the time. He also, Merck, you may know to this, he entered the week trailing only Jose Altuve in Baseball Reference's WAR calculation. So we know not all that is, you know, tied to the offense. A lot of that's tied to the defensive values provided in right field. But really, he's probably been their most productive or most valuable regular here in the early going.
Yeah, he was actually leading in Baseball Reference defensive WAR going into this series against the Yankees. And, you know, it's interesting. He's a very proud kid, very direct kid, good guy, too, you know, and you can tell he really enjoys what he's doing. But he made an interesting point to me in that story about you know, leading in the WAR. And to be honest with you, I don't think these guys really worry too much. I know there are a few. I've seen stories about a few who really do study the sabermetrics, but I don't think they really know. I don't think anyone comes to the park and says, hey, guys, you see I was leading in isolated power or something like that, you know. But he said he feels a little, I don't know what the word is for it, I guess disappointed that people, because he had a rough year last year, and let's face it, the whole team had a really rough year in 15, in center field, that people have already automatically, it's funny how he talks more, almost as much about not wanting to be pigeonholed as just a good right fielder and a bad center fielder, and reminding people that, you know, in 2014, he was a finalist for the Gold Glove in center field. So I think what he's trying to say is that just because he's playing great right field right now doesn't mean it's guaranteed the rest of the year, but just because he played poor center field last year, or had a poor year in center field last year, doesn't mean he's not a good defensive outfielder overall who can play in a number of different positions. So I understand that. You know, I mean, I think in one hand, it's kind of like, you know, someone saying, hey, that's a great new haircut, because they didn't like your old haircut, you know? And I think that's what he's taking it a little bit as, that, wow, you really are a great right fielder, because, man, you couldn't do it in center field last year. he kind of disagrees with that.
Well, it's understandable. You're right. The reputation did change in a hurry as far as the sense of value, and it can change back the other way in a hurry. We see that a lot. Miguel Gonzalez would like to change his reputation with the White Sox from the early going. He's got a 5.17 ERA so far, 9 earned runs, 15 and two-thirds innings, 1.85 whip. I know they want to see this play out and see what they have in Gonzalez, but what's the thought process going forward with him? And I guess how long do you think that leash is, Bert?
Well, as you know from covering many, many games in your time, there's nothing that slows a game down more for someone covering the game than a large amount of walks, you know, than a pitcher who's kind of, I don't want to say nibbling around the strike zone, but just missing the zone. And I can only imagine what it's like for the players who were standing behind him and trying to stay focused. And, you know, as Bob Uecker would say, ball 8, ball 12, ball 16. Now, it wasn't that bad for Gonzalez. He thought his stuff was almost too good. He was getting too much movement because his sinker was working. He was getting ground ball outs in that game against the Yankees, but you got to throw strikes. And I understand that there was a little bit of, you know, question with the home plate umpire. I think that went on both sides. I happened to be looking up at the TV a couple of times when I saw some pitches Tanaka threw that were pretty close in that game as well. So, yeah, I think he's just got to focus. He's not a big strikeout guy. Even in his best years at Baltimore, he wasn't a strikeout guy. So he's just got to attack and get those ground ball outs. And answer to your question, yeah, I think he's still the guy. I don't think there's anyone else in the picture right now, barring, you know, any kind of surprise signing or trade. Carson Fulmer is not ready yet. He walked 8 guys his last time out. He's their top pitching prospect. You know, Eric Johnson had a shot. He may get another one at some point, but right now I think, you know, Gonzalez above Johnson and Chris Beck and Jacob Turner and Carson Fulmer is the interim answer for the White Sox.
The Indians are going to need some good luck with Michael Brantley back on the shelf, put back on the DL with shoulder inflammation. And this is obviously the second time they've had to kind of walk this back a little bit during spring training. There was, you know, too much too soon at that point, and he was held out of action for a little bit. And now same thing here in the regular season. Take us through the thought process there and what's going on with Brantley's shoulder.
Yeah, well, first of all, I think the real easy reaction here for fans is to say, oh, look, they rushed into it. Like, they should have waited. You know, I think in hindsight, that's obviously the knee-jerk reaction. But I think it's one of those situations where, you know, Brantley said he felt great. He was doing rehab games in the minors and was bouncing back better than he did when he tried to start playing games during spring training. Reached a point where he was playing back-to-back games and, you know, felt good with his swing and everything. And when your star player says, I feel great, I'm bouncing back well, you know, let's do this. You know, it's. I think you got to try it. You got to see if it's legit. And I think they were very conservative and precautious with how they handled his comeback. And even after he rejoined the team, you know, working in days off or planning his playing time around scheduled off days, so he wasn't going 3-4 games in a row right out of the chute. And unfortunately, you know, after playing up for a couple weeks, you know, he runs back into some fatigue again with that shoulder. So, you know, I think, in hindsight, yeah, maybe they did bring him back a little sooner than he should have come back. But also, there's no way that they would have known that, you know, based on how Brantley was feeling at the time and based on the, you know, the evaluations by the medical team and everybody else. So it's an unfortunate situation because now for, you know, another DL stint, the Indians are kind of shorthanded in that outfield in terms of the outfield they like to have. But again, as we noted early on this season, they continue to hover around that 500 mark. And if they can continue to do that throughout the middle course of this regular season while waiting for Brantley to get back to full strength and while waiting for Carlos Carrasco to get back to full strength, you know, I think that's a good spot to be in for when they do hopefully get those guys back for the rest of the season.
Yeah, I guess one clue with Brantley, he wasn't really driving the ball much in a short time with the Tribe. He'll meet with his surgeon in Delaware on Tuesday, so we'll get an update then. But yeah, in the meantime, outfield very much in flux. Tyler Naquin is back, JB, and, you know, when he was sent down, his defense was pointed to as one concern. that was kind of something you thought you could bank on with Naquin. He's got the strong arm and thought that the defense in center field would be strong. The defensive metrics weren't particularly strong, though, on his first stint with the Indians. And then he comes back, and Sunday seemed to misjudge the ball off Rosario's bat in Sunday's game. What do you think about Naquin coming along as a defender in center field?
Yeah, I mean, it's easy to look at a kid who's hitting 300 in the big leagues and wonder why on earth would they send this guy down. But, you know, obviously, first of all, options play a role in that, you know, maintaining depth. But the other thing that Terry Francona and Brad Mills, bench coach, who works with the outfielders, have talked about is his first step and his route efficiency. You know, one thing on that particular ball that you mentioned in the game against the Twins, Francona said, you know, really good major league center fielders, one thing that they do very well is seeing the ball off the bat and then picking a spot to run to without keeping their eye on the ball, you know, and then picking the ball up before it comes back down, you know, once they get to that spot. That is still something that Naquin is learning to do at the higher levels, and that's something that they've been working with him on, especially during pregame, you know, batting practice, things like that. Brad Mills spent a lot of time, and, you know, from all indications are, Naquin is putting in a lot of work out there. But, you know, in defensive metrics, obviously a lot of room for error, you know, especially when you're dealing with small sample size. But in terms of all major league center fielders, Naquin's last in defensive runs saved. In terms of the, I think it was 34 center fielders with 100-plus innings, he was last in ultimate zone rating per 150 games. You know, so this is a guy that the metrics, you know, are really painting a negative picture of right now. That arm really plays. I think that's why when they had him down in the minors, he had one game in right field, and they played him in right for a little bit when he came back up the second stint. You know, maybe down the road he profiles better as a right fielder, especially when you know you've got guys like Zimmer and Frazier coming up through the system as well, because he does have a really, really strong arm, and that was the one thing they've raved about throughout his minor league career. But, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if he's back down in AAA at some point because the defense has been an issue, and it's something they really want him to focus on and hone.
Now, while we're on the subject of the outfield, Indians outfielders have 4 home runs this season going into Monday's action. Only the Braves, with 2, have fewer across the majors. So, obviously, not much power production from those outfield spots, which we knew going into the season was going to be kind of a hodgepodge and guys rotating around, but that's certainly an eye-catching number here early on. Along those lines, JB, Yan Gomes has had some eye-catching numbers offensively in a negative fashion, batting 167 with a 557 OPS, but he delivered a little power over the weekend, had a couple home runs. And, you know, sometimes with catchers, you don't really put much stock in their offensive numbers anyway, especially this early in the season, because it's so much more important what they're doing, the work they're doing with the pitching staff and controlling the running game and things of that nature. But obviously this is a guy you're hoping for or counting on for a bounce back from an offensive perspective in that lineup, and have to be encouraged by the last couple of days at least.
Right. I mean, this is a guy that won a Silver Slugger a couple of years ago, and you know, I think we've talked about it during the spring training was, you know, when all the talk about right-handed power and wanting to inject more of it, I think the hope was maybe Yan Gomes would just be that internal solution. Hasn't really been there yet, but he hit home runs on Friday and Saturday. You know, he even admitted that after the home run on Friday, you know, he kind of uncharacteristically let out a little shout as he came out of the batter's box because it just felt like a huge weight lifted off his shoulders. I think he broke an 0-for-20 slide with that home run. He was 2-for-42 going into that at bat. And so to have 2 games in a row where you clear the fence, it just goes, it does a lot for his confidence, I think, going forward. Francona said there were still some wild swings in those 2 games, you know, so it's not like he's completely fixed offensively, but obviously to be able to walk in after the game knowing that you've helped the team out offensively, which you hadn't been doing, That's a good step forward. Hitting coach Ty Van Berkelio, I chatted with him about it. He said they've been working with Gomes on his sort of his direction with his stride leg in his stance and his swing. So that's something they're trying to get more consistent with. And he feels that there's been progress behind the scenes. So hopefully you see that uptick. He's kind of a streaky hitter because he doesn't walk a lot. So the hits will either be sort of coming in bunches or you'll go through a long drought. been in a long drought out of the gates here. I think what's really encouraging with Jan, though, is over the last few years, Francona has done a really good job of kind of training him to put the offense contributions as secondary, and you haven't really seen it affect him in terms of controlling the running game, leading the pitching staff, things like that, which Gomes really values as his number one priority.
And Rhett, the Twins coming off of a series win in Cleveland, an Indian team that they've had a lot of success against this season. Haven't had much success against the rest of the league, unfortunately. But I was watching Sunday's game, and Tyler Duffy, very impressive. The strength of that curveball, particularly, it's something we saw down the stretch last season. He's had good command of it here in 2016. He now has a 1.85 ERA in four starts. Seven shutout innings against the Indians on Sunday. What have you thought of Duffy here? Obviously, you know, he didn't seize the moment in spring training, so to speak, to seize a rotation job, but he's certainly making the most of this opportunity these last few times out.
Yeah, definitely. He's been very, very impressive. As you said, last year he was pretty much their best starter on the stretch as a rookie. But in spring, you know, he was given a chance to win a rotation spot and was kind of even put in pencil to start the season. But didn't have a very good, spring there. Malone and Alaska had a much better spring. He got a bigger contract, probably played into it a little bit too. And they wanted Duffy to work on his changeup. So at the time, it made some sense. And with the way that everything was kind of spaced out in April, they figured he'd only miss a couple starts anyway, and then they could bring him up at some point. And sure enough, with injuries, he's up here, and he's really taking advantage of it. He's still just as good as he was last year. He is throwing the changeup a little bit, a couple times a game, but still kind of more of that fastball, curveball mix. And he mixes in with a four-seamer with his two-seamer, so at least it's a little bit like a third pitch. Like yesterday against Carlos Santana, you know, he struck him out with like an 88-mile-per-hour, two-seamer that kind of took something off. Almost looked like a changeup, a little bit different of a pitch than usually what you see from him. So he does kind of work with that a little bit as well. But, yeah, you're right, that curveball is the big out pitch for him. Been very, very impressive so far. We'll see if he can keep it up with that two-pitch kind of mix, but definitely been their best pitcher so far in the early going in those four starts.
Yeah, you got to give him credit, because what he did down the stretch, you wondered about sample size, and this is a guy who's never like a major prospect, nationally speaking, but he's certainly making good on the developments, the strides he made last year. Let's talk about Byron Buxton, a guy who obviously needed some development, further development in the minor league level. That's why they sent him down. He was batting a .56 with a .208 on base percentage at the time, 17 big league games at the time they sent him back down to AAA. Since being sent down, Rhett, he's batting .301, getting on base about 35% of the time. Got a slugging percentage just south of .500. Things are looking good stat-wise. What are the Twins saying about his approach down there?
Yeah, they're happy with it so far. I think he's cut down on the strikeouts, which is a big thing. I think, up in the majors, he struck out in about half of his plate appearances. Down in the minors, it's about one in every four, one out of every five at-bats. He's striking out, which is certainly a better ratio. They'd like to see him draw some more walks. And he maybe hit for a little bit more power. I think he has three homers this month, but I think only two extra base hits in the last week or so. So I think once he kind of gets that going and kind of a little bit more power, a little bit more patience, he'll be up here again soon. But definitely a good sign. Like I said, he's hitting over .300. He's really, started to heat up here in May. He had a little bit of a back injury a couple days ago on Saturday, left the game, but I was told it was very minor. It was mostly because it was, I think it was 39 degrees that day. It was very cold, so they took him out of the game with a little bit of a back issue. But, good sign. We'll see how it kind of goes. Danny Santana's done, decent in center field, kind of in his absence. So the Twins have to kind of decide when it makes the most sense to bring him up. But for now, I think they're happy with him kind of continually develop down there, kind of get some at-bats every day, cut down on those strikeouts, make better contact. I think he's changed his mechanics a little bit too, shorten up his swing a little bit to get more contact, as well as kind of, I think he's reintroduced a little bit of a leg kick that he did in spring that he kind of dished a little bit during the season. So, I think he's got a little bit, more time, maybe a couple more weeks before they bring him up. But Twins are definitely very pleased with the progress he's been making.
Well, good to see him, putting himself on the radar. So sometimes you wonder, a guy gets sent down like that, what it does to his confidence level. And it certainly seems like, he's gone down there and gotten his work in, basically. Not, put his head down and making those strides he needs to make from a discipline standpoint, especially. Rhett, how about Eduardo Nunez's year? Cast as a utility guy the last five or six seasons or so. He gets the opportunity at third base early on when Trevor Plouffe went on the DL, and then at short when Eduardo Escobar got hurt, and he's really running with it.
Yeah, he really is. I mean, he's hitting close to 350. He started off really, you know, on fire. I think he was like 7-for-11 to start the season. It hasn't really slowed down, though. I mean, he's really been, you know, power and speed. You know, he's got a lot of stolen bases. Defensively, he has some versatility. Like you said, he kind of filled in there at third base capably for Plouffe. And then now he's at shortstop with Escobar in the DL. Still never going to be much of a plus defender, but, you know, he certainly can kind of move him around the infield and not have to worry about him too much. And then, like I said, the offense has been a big surprise. But, I mean, even last year as a utility guy for the Twins, you know, I think he hit 280, you know, with some power. Had a, you know, pretty good year off the bench, to be honest. But I thought, you know, if he does that again this year, that'll be, you know, perfectly fine. But so far, he's been above and beyond that, and it's been a big boost for this team that has had, you know, some costly injuries in the infield. Curious to see kind of how it plays out once Escobar comes back, just because at this point, you know, he's been such a hot bat that they'd love to keep that in there. And Escobar is starting to cool off a little bit before his injury. So you can see they maybe share it a little bit more when he gets back. But I guess it kind of depends on how Nunez does in the meantime before Escobar gets back in a couple of weeks or so. But, yeah, I mean, his on-base percentage is, you know, not as great. He doesn't draw a ton of walks. And the big thing, too, is his batting average on balls in play is certainly way above his average, you know, for his career. So it's probably going to come down. He's not going to hit like this all year, obviously. But, you know, he's certainly a utility guy that they like and they can bring some offense, and really has been a big contributor so far this season.
Yeah, it says a lot about Paul Molitor's, you know, comfortability with him right now. He's got him in the two hole. That speaks volumes right there.
Yeah, exactly. That really is. I mean, to put him in up there at number two, especially now they're using Joe Mauer as their leadoff hitter and moving Dozier down to number six, it shows that Molitor has a lot of confidence in the way he can handle the bat. And like I said, even just as a base runner, he's a very, very aggressive base runner. His helmet always flies off every time he runs, but outside of that, he's a great base runner and a good base stealer. And for now, with the way he's hitting, it makes sense to put him up at number two and let, you know, hopefully that Mauer gets on base and have him get on base as well and kind of let the power guys like Sano and Park and Plouffe and Dozier kind of hit behind him.
Yeah, you mentioned Dozier moving down. He turned 29 years old on Sunday. He was gifted with a day off and should be back in the lineup Monday. But he's batting .346 over his last eight games, driven in four runs in that span. Starting to, you know, water kind of finding its level there with Dozier after the slow start.
Yeah, I think so. And the big thing, too, I talked to him a couple weeks ago in Houston. And right around then was when the kind of things started to change for him. And I think the big thing was just mechanically he changed some things and also even just changed where he is, you know, in relative to the plate. He was standing too close to the plate and kind of crowding it too much. And he realized that he wasn't able to get to the inside pitches that he thought were, like, you know, pitches in on his hands were actually just pitches that were, you know, kind of right over the middle of the plate. But I think once he backed off the plate a little bit, adjusted his foot angle, he's had some more power and been able to drive the ball a little better. Because that was kind of the issue, was kind of, you know, strange to see him. You know, he wasn't even really popping the ball up like he does. And, you know, you were seeing him strike out too much, which he doesn't do as much. And just kind of looking at, you know, some pitches that looked like they were good pitches, but they just were kind of too close for him because he's standing too close to play. It's kind of a weird deal, but I think he kind of figured that out after watching some video. And ever since then, he's been hitting the ball a lot better.
Back, the Tigers had a huge comeback win Sunday in Baltimore. Really can't overstate how much they did that. They've dropped 11 of their last 13 overall going into this week's series with the Twins. Obviously, you know, we talked about this last week, Brad Ausmus' job security. It continued to be a talking point as the losses have piled up. And I don't know that one win necessarily takes all the heat off. But, you know, where do things stand, do you think, with Ausmus? And is that leash shortening by what's developed here the last couple of weeks?
Well, it's going to be interesting to follow because while they have struggled mightily, they've been playing some pretty tough opponents the last few series. Now, that said, they hadn't played good baseball against those opponents. So, I mean, that's more concerning maybe even in the results. I think it's interesting from the standpoint that their stretch of baseball gets easier here coming up, not just with the homestand, but also with the opponents they're playing, starting with the Twins and Rays this week. And then going forward after that, there's a chance for them to pick up some wins and maybe build some momentum. That said, if they don't get it going in this stretch, then if it's possible to worry even more about them, then I think you do. But you know, at least if you can survive to this point, you can at least see an opportunity to rack up some wins and maybe get a chance to have this team playing a little bit better.
Yeah, they could certainly use a nice run. We know that going into the Twin Series, Cameron Maben will be back on the active roster after suffering that wrist fracture, about 2 months ago at this point. What's the plan with Maben here moving forward? And also, Beck, what went in the decision to send down Anthony Ghost as opposed to Stephen Moya, who had obviously just been recently promoted?
Well, on the Maben part, you know, he pretty much shapes up to be the everyday center fielder now, I would expect. Unless they get some road trips and some smaller ballparks where you feel comfortable playing Justin Upton in center, Maben shapes up to be the primary guy, overwhelmingly so, with Anthony goes down. I think they're looking for an offensive injection. I think they're looking for somebody to not just provide speed there, but also provide some better overall contribution. They've been waiting for Maben to get healthy to move Ghost out of the lineup until they couldn't wait any longer. And then they started getting creative with some opportunities there really for the last few weeks. You saw Tyler Collins get a couple games there homestand before that, which ended in ill-fated fashion. Andrew Romine got a little bit of playing time out there. But then you had the Upton experiment in the smaller outfield in Baltimore. Now, the Ghost thing has been a frustrating point, I think, for Ausmus, really, for the most part, since the start of the season, where you know the bat just wasn't coming around. And it got to the point where the speed and some of the ability he provided on defense wasn't enough to justify the regular spots and the outs that were going on.
And Moya finished a homer shy of the cycle on Sunday, so he's making his case to stick around. One guy we know is sticking around, Beck, is Justin Verlander, of course, and had a really rough outing in Cleveland a couple weeks back. I remember going into that, Brad Ausmus had made the point that, look, this guy's only had one bad start going back to last July, and then sure enough, that night he got roughed up. But ever since then, two straight dominant outings from JV. Are we starting to see more of the guy we saw in the second half last season?
Well, if you look historically, this is around the time in a lot of seasons where he starts turning things around, at least when he started out the year healthy. All the way back to 2009 and then 2011, 2012, it was really around early to mid-May when the weather started warming up that Verlander usually would round in the form for some reason or another. And it seems like that might be the case here. I know he said after that Cleveland outing that he kind of feels like this reminds him of 2009, in that April was a mess. May was starting out as a transition period for him, that he felt like he was really kind of on the cusp of finding that form. He looks sharper. He looks more effective. He's able to rattle off some long stretches of outs and get that offense back at the plate. So we'll see. I mean, he's going to have a couple more opportunities here. You know, again, not to pound on the schedule, but he's going to have a couple more opportunities here to put together some strong outings. So, we'll see what he can do heading into Memorial Day weekend.
Beck, how about J.D. Martinez? He was 7 for 52 with 20 strikeouts in 13 games entering Sunday. And then in the eighth inning Sunday, he checks his swing on a 2-2 pitch, just barely avoids the strikeout there, and then drills the next pitch over the wall from Darren O'Day to tie up that game. And then Miggy Cabrera follows with a home run of his own. The Tigers win. How huge was that home run for J.D. Martinez?
That's big. Now, that said, you know, he was able to provide a little bit of punch off of Scherzer last week, and it didn't really carry over.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's going to take more than one hit, but it's at least gives him some positive reinforcement, and at least gives him a chance to maybe take a deep breath.